Chapter 3 Planet Iaga. After the Iagans had explained their concept of efficiency, they turned without pause to their ideas of justice. In the same relentless and efficient manner, I was pumped full of the laws upon which they based their social and economic system in a very short time. The main theme was the same: the efficiency of the justice. It's interesting to fully understand what a cosmic universal economic system is. They explain it as follows: an economic plan, aimed at efficiently satisfying man's needs so that he is released from the tyranny of material things over his daily life. In other words, if everyone has everything at his disposal, then the acquisition of material goods is no longer of paramount importance. This can only be achieved by providing equal shares for everyone, otherwise envy will always exist. The culture then becomes more or less stable. I nodded in agreement. Mankind released from material problems, no envy or greed, that was an answer. Only one small problem: how is it done? A little magic perhaps? There are only two solutions: everyone must own the same, or no one must own anything. The last is the most efficient. I sat bolt upright in my chair. Were they telling me, a well-to-do company director, that I must dispense with personal property? These beings were pure communists. It was useless to carry on this conversation, it was getting me nowhere. I sat wondering if I should voice my displeasure, but the explanation continued with the following hypothesis: consequently, because money is an unmistakable form of property, it should be abolished. They went even further. Personal property is an indication of a very primitive level of culture. We had enough intelligence to build rockets, but not enough to see that the laws of the survival of the fittest and the mightiest right must be abolished. Perhaps I could explain to them how I thought we could survive with such a system. Because though ours was a highly interesting system, what they had found here in discrimination beat anything that they had ever encountered before. Earth people seem to be continually occupied with thinking of new discriminations, and using them as solutions to the ones that already exist. Someone could not formulate any social or political plan without someone else immediately attacking it. I really must not blame the spacemen when they said that all this useless talking, the continual working against one another, made them laugh. On the other hand, it was more terrifying than amusing that power had now been added to this difference in insight in the form of an atomic weapon arsenal which had an unimaginable destructive and poisonous effect. And all this under the control of a few buttons. How was it possible that we could still sleep peacefully? One learns to live with things that are impossible to change. What a foolish idea! Of course it was possible to change things. All we had to do was to stop discriminating, simply change our laws. The concept of private property, of course, stood in our way. But surely we could sort that out. Point one didn't think so. Abolish personal possessions? Never would that work. While we are all quite willing to improve the world, it had to begin with our neighbor. Surely even a selfish man can understand that a world without discrimination would be a better place in which to live. Perhaps we could even create a prosperity that, universally speaking, could be 10 times better than that of the present. That they could understand. It was a pity that the communistic ideals were lost in inefficiency, otherwise they could have done a lot of good. It was a case of state-controlled economic leaders making the decisions. My humor improved considerably. They were not communists after all. But what were they, then? I will try, briefly, to explain their system, as far as I was able to understand it. The total production of goods and services is, on Iaga, in the hands of a very small number of huge companies, the trusts. These are huge organizations with millions of employees, active over their whole planet. There are primary trusts, which distribute directly to the consumer, and secondary trusts, which supply the primary. Nothing is paid for on Iaga, only registered. What a consumer uses is registered in the computer center in each of the house cylinders, and this may not exceed that to which he has a right. These computers are coupled to the huge shopping centers in each of the cylinders. You cannot buy anything. Large and expensive things, such as houses, cars, boats, valuable artifacts, and so on, can only be hired. They call this the right of acquisition. Less expensive things are not hired because that is not efficient. They are registered for their total value and the right of use remains for life. This is almost the same as personal ownership, except that in the event of death, the goods are returned to the trusts. The last category is articles for consumption and public services. Their total value is registered, at which point right of usage becomes yours. As far as goods are concerned, you may not have more in stock than is reasonable for your own use, otherwise the surplus can be confiscated. It is practically the same sort of thing as a bank account, except that they place the control on the expenditure, whereas we place it on the income. This difference is worth a lot of thought. Legally, all the goods remain the property of the trusts that supplied them. This means not only that the trust is responsible for the upkeep, repair and the guarantee of a certain minimum life, but they also take the total risk of loss or destruction. Thus, all the articles are made to such a high standard that repair is never necessary. Repairs are not only expensive but terribly inefficient. Insurance companies and repair firms would make a poor living on Iaga. The trusts work on a cost-price basis whereby a term profit is replaced by the cost of continuation. Each trust was constantly occupied with improving and expanding its production. Their economy was as stable as a rock. They showed me two of their fully automatic factory complexes, one that produced cars and another that produced the transoceanic rail bridges. The star-shaped building had a diameter of about 1 kilometer and the area around the factory was a maze of rails supporting hundreds of their freight torpedoes which entered the building at the points of the star. The film then moved to the factory's interior. The points of the star contained the automatic unbaiting system that emptied the trains of their raw materials, and this was the first time that I was able to hear original sounds. Strange hollow knocking, interposed with screeches and clicks. It was an inferno of noise that echoed strangely in the small metal chamber in which I was sitting. The same realistic effect as the film itself, left, right, above, below, I heard the sounds exactly as if I had been present when they were made, and I began to hear exactly which machine was making a particular noise. The size of the machine park was indescribable. Boilers, collectors, hinging lids, ovens with white-hot metal, presses that belched steam each time they opened, huge horseshoe-shaped sections with high-voltage insulators and spark-spitting machines. Small, delicate machines turned, twisted or juggled with their products. I saw a few Iagans at work, dressed in orange-colored overalls with space suit-like helmets on their HS which left only the mouth and nose uncovered. There were never more than about 40 workers outside the control room. The production lines converged towards the middle of the factory and it became clear that this factory produced automobiles. The most sinister, I found, were the metal claws that functioned exactly the same way as a human hand and arm. They were mounted on a system of arms and made movements exactly as a living being would. Large ones moved slowly, and small ones moved at lightning speed, exactly synchronized with the placing of a part. The machine completed its task piece for piece until a complete product emerged at the end of the line, faultless, fast, and untouched by human hand. It was mostly the claws that gave the impression that this monster with all its noise, had an intellect of its own. The two production lines joined exactly in the middle of the star, the complete undersection of the car, complete with wheels, seats, steering and controls was joined in one operation to the upper section with glass, doors and the rails keys. Here I saw the most impressive battery of arms and claws. The finished automobiles were picked up by the skis, swung round, and placed onto the rail system exactly next to the previous one, with only a few millimeters between them. The camera rested for a while on this end phase, and it began to dawn on me just exactly what this machine was capable of doing. This kilometer-long monster that knew no failure, turned raw material into a finished automobile at the rate of 1 every 20 seconds. Or 4,500 per day. When my noise-numbed brain registered this, I got a rather strange feeling in my stomach. This was inhuman. They were also kind enough to show me another factory that produced the transoceanic rail bridges, but I will spare you the details. The need to continually write in superlatives tends to bring aversion. My comments can be condensed into one word: terrible. How the Eargons can develop and build such mechanical monsters is a mystery to me. They also thought it desirable to show me the robot production of the houses. Even a non-fissioned Earthman could surely understand something of the advantages of standardization. Thank them kindly for the offer, but I had seen enough of all that automation, where Eargons only checked to see that everything was working properly. I was quite prepared to accept the fact that they could build houses fully automatically. They were disappointed, but perhaps I would like to see how they assembled the units into the huge cylinders? Okay, just to please them. How do Eargons build their houses? This efficiency began to tickle my sense of humor. They began by building a factory, on site, and placed in it one of the mechanical monsters that produced the complete, ready for use, plastic housing units. Each unit was roughly 60 by 60 feet and 18 feet high, completely finished with glass, furniture, household machines, communication system, and so on, divided into two layers or floors. On the site itself lay, in the ground, a huge, star-shaped rib construction with a diameter of more than 900 feet. Just as the roofs of the cylinders were domed, so was the foundation, but with the convex side under, like a half-discus. The ribs were joined in the middle to a huge ring, the depth of the ribs at this point being approximately 60 feet. The plating on the underside of the ribs was dark gray and looked rather like the skin of their spaceships. On this saucer foundation, a massive cylinder with a steel frame was built, filled in with something that looked like black concrete, the whole construction having a diameter of approximately 800 feet and a wall thickness of approximately 9 feet. The whole construction was covered by the domed roof, which seemed to be almost as strong as the foundations, only this roof was covered by glass. On the outside of this cylindrical wall were rows of heavy support beams, onto which the house units were placed, each unit fitting perfectly against the insulated surfaces of its neighbor. If one of the units should be damaged at any time, for example by fire, then it was simply removed and a new one put in its place. A wonderful piece of engineering. The working life of these constructions was calculated to be at least 1,000 years. When I hear you continually talking about quality and a useful life of thousands of years, and a rail system that can stand for hundreds of years, I get the feeling that your plans for the future make ours, which only take into account the next 20 or 30 years, look like child's play, I told them during a break in the film. The explanation is not difficult, a spokesman answered calmly. A race that lives under the constant threat of war and destruction does not logically make any plans for the distant future. For an absolute race, that is different. The continual improvement of our mental capacity directs our thoughts more and more into the future. We have created a planet on which our race can survive for an eternity. We live in a stable world on a clean planet, where the balance of nature can be maintained for unlimited time. We live for the future, because we expect great things from it. We are constantly occupied with making our world a better place to live in. The Earth, on the other hand, lives for the present and the past, and does not worry about the future generations. Remarkable, this far-sighted concern for future generations. When you understand what a superculture represents, you will share our concern. I was delighted when they agreed to my request to see one of their flying saucers. I cherished the hope that we might also become capable of constructing such a machine. But, alas, the technique was so advanced that I was unable to understand the first thing about it. It was a beautiful, polished, silver, streamlined discus, about 90 feet in diameter, with a domed glass pane, above the below in the middle. There were slots around the rim on the underside, and when the machine flew low over the ground, I could see dust being blown up. I thought at first that this was caused by air pressure, but they explained that it was due to the ground echo from the anti-gravity machine. It was astounding to see just what these machines could do. They showed me the transportation of a rail section to an inaccessible mountain area. The saucer lifted the heavy section on two steel cables and transported it effortlessly over the mountains. It was maneuverable in all directions, and could, even in a storm, hover motionlessly in the air. It was equally capable of operating either in the atmosphere or outside it. In answer to my remark that it was surely, then, a spaceship, I was told that they were confined to the gravitational field of the planet. Gravity was their only means of returning to the surface. One therefore had to be careful not to fly fast enough to exceed the escape velocity, which would then necessitate rescue by a real spaceship. My request to be allowed to see one of their spaceships was politely refused, perhaps at the end of our conversation. They felt that we had much more important things to discuss than technique. They thought that they had sufficiently described the production facilities and the investment capacity of their trusts, and that I could now be interested in their structure. To be quite honest, I had at the moment very little interest in structures. A society without personal ownership was all very well and good as a curiosity, but I did not see any practical use for it. I was later to regret my attitude, for the efficiency of radiation information is dependent on the interest of the student, and because of my lack of interest, I missed an important part of the organizational structure. I remember only a small part of it. The system worked with divisions and branches that were as far removed from one another, geographically, as possible, and allowed for automatic production. At the head of each trust was a president who was a member of the production group of the world government. The trusts competed with each other, and the prices were determined by the law of supply and demand, the principle of the free market. Their cost price was computed on the standard work hour, the URA. Cont. Under, text for UFO drawing, small disc-shaped anti-gravity air vehicles observed were not capable of flight outside of a gravity field. They were a beautifully polished silver in color, were highly streamlined, and were about 90 feet in diameter with a transparent dome above and below in the center. There were slots around the rim on the underside. The performance of these vehicles was astounding. They were observed lifting whole sections of the rail system structure into place in mountainous areas with ease. Their operation is confined to the gravitational field of a planet. Text. Cont. Here, my question as to how they calculated the cost of natural resources was answered by saying that in a society where personal ownership did not exist, natural resources were, in principle, free. This meant that the price was calculated from the cost of winning, processing and distribution. How can a trust that works on a cost-price basis sell gold, for example, which, due to the law of supply and demand, represents a much higher income than its cost price? I asked. You use gold as an example, but there are many scarce articles that represent a profit far above the cost price. This is not a problem. The trusts simply absorb this extra profit and use it to subsidize other articles in the production scheme. Careful central planning can also influence the law of supply and demand. Surely that can be done by advertising? Then they really went to town. What we did under the guise of advertising and public relations was something that bordered on indecency. The money and manpower, in other words, potential prosperity that we limit for a non-efficient brain. Can you imagine what these Earth people thought of now? Artificial aging. A continual stream of seemingly new models compelled our status symbol-oriented society to discard things before they had reached the end of their useful life. A terrible waste of raw material and production capacity, and, even worse, it was a stimulant for jealousy and greed, and this was criminal. This promotion of materialism, a deadly danger for an intelligent race, was directly opposed to any idea of justice. I thought they were finished, but their most remarkable argument was yet to come. Our advertising was a despicable form of propaganda which was ethically unacceptable. In a socially stable society, you had not only freedom of speech, but, even more important, freedom of thought. Propaganda, repeated one-sided information, damaged the freedom of thought, and that was unacceptable discrimination. My tentative question as to how they could practice competition without advertising initiated another detailed explanation. Competition exists only through the free choice of the consumers, and has nothing to do with trying to influence that choice, as we try to do with advertising. They influenced this choice, naturally, much more efficiently. On eARGA, there are two worldwide consumer organizations, which are responsible for all market research. They examine the usage value of all the goods and services and inform the public in the most objective manner about the available assortment. They stimulate the trusts to produce the goods that are needed. The trusts are not permitted to advertise or exert any influence on the consumer, as this could never be objective. Thus, the choice is not made by an expert or unprice-conscious persons but by experts with test facilities at their disposal. When, for example, they see that it is necessary that the public have a choice of 5 different types of television sets, then they ensure that these are produced. I didn't believe a word of it. From what I had seen on eARGA, there was no choice at all. Everything seemed the same: cars, houses, trains, and so on. They were afraid that I had failed to understand anything of what they had told me. The presidents of the two trusts are a part of the central planning group of the world government. This group attempts to lead the race to the goal of a culture. To begin with, they must, by means of production adjustment, dispense with the law of supply and demand, and thereafter create a situation of unbridled prosperity, so that no one is troubled anymore by material things. As a result, this group also stimulates the mental development of the race. Take, for example, the cars and houses. There comes a time when the cultural level has reached a point where these no longer function as status symbols. What then influences the choice of the public? 2 things, mainly: comfort and price. Maximum comfort and low production cost can only be achieved with robot automation. And what happens then? Everyone chooses the most efficient car and the most efficient house, and so the development proceeds. Another thing that has a great influence on consumption is the general interest in the conservation of natural resources. A race that lives for the future is concerned with the utmost efficient use of natural resources, because the longer the planet is inhabited, the scarcer these become. The presidents of the consumer trusts have a great influence in these things, because they have public opinion behind them. All right, I understand the relationship between the trusts and the public. But, now, how much does such a president earn as compared to the lowest paid worker? The question is not easily answered. The goal of the universal economic system is naturally the leveling of income, but that is not possible in the early stages of social stability. A material reward must be offered to stimulate a greater personal effort. A similar reward must also be offered to stimulate young people to complete the long studies necessary to reach high technological development, or to induce people to work harder or to accept more responsibility. You must begin by determining a social minimum that everyone always receives, and you must attempt to establish security for everyone, young and old. Women also have a right to their own income. The social minimum must be free of any discrimination. You must also determine that the maximum and the combined income for a man and wife can never exceed 4 times the determined minimum. Do you think that you could find presidents here who would be willing to accept such a modest income? Of course, as long as the minimum is high enough. A president and wife earn, for example, 8 euros, and the minimum is 20 euros. How do you cope with general costs, the kind that we pay for with taxes? They are calculated in the price of consumer goods and services. Doesn't this make the price rather high? Now you are thinking in terms of money and payment, while on eARGA, money does not exist and nothing is paid for. What we conveniently call price is in fact purely a method of expressing the production time demanded by a certain article, and is only used to determine the distribution of prosperity. When you ask if the prices are high, you really mean to ask if there is a lot available to us, if we are rich or poor. In fact, you are asking about the production level per head of the population, and compared to Earth's standards, this is very high. The answer is, we are all rich. the universal economic system that exists by a great many intelligent races, does not concern itself with money, possession, or payment. The aim of this system is to free the people from material influences and motivation, and in contrast to the Earth's economy, this system is very simple. It can be explained in a couple of minutes. The explanation is indeed simple, but it must be accompanied by one or two marginal notes. It appears to be a socialist heaven, and as such is rather misleading. Earthly Marxism makes the fault of thinking that all people are good, and that only their social and economic situation makes them bad. Change their situation and the problem is solved. If only this were true. Every intelligent race is dualistic, and as absolute necessity, contains an extremely evil consciousness component that now and again comes to the surface in the form of lies, deceit, sadism, homicide, etc., etc. One of the reasons for the terrible murder of millions of women and children in gas chambers. A detailed explanation will come later, so let it suffice here to say that beings on Iago that possess this mentality are denied reincarnation. This selection is the cause of the continuing improvement in mentality, generation after generation, which enables a race to become unselfish. On Earth, this selection was blocked some 20 centuries ago by extraterrestrial intervention whereby we cannot improve our average mentality. This system is therefore unsuitable and undesirable for us because it would stimulate the egoism. The lazy and the profiteers would disrupt the system. The universal economic system is just an utopian dream for us. The beginning of this system is their world order. The unity of such a race comes from the fact that they obey a set of godly laws and therefore have a uniform legal system. Add this to their love of travel, which results in the mixing of the races, and the result is the disappearance of nationalism, which happened long ago. The total production of all goods and services is controlled by globally operating trusts or cooperatives, the presidents of which form the world government. These are not so much economic as political formations that perform most of the tasks that fall here under governments and ministries. The consumers' cooperations comment on the performance of the trusts and so stimulate the assortment and availability. Once this situation has been reached, there is not much left to be written in a book on economics. The only thing that could be entered is any idea to improve the system's product efficiency, which will reduce the amount of servile labor. They regard this kind of work as a waste of time. Appropriately, they use the term welfare efficiency of the working population. The theoretical maximum of 100% could be reached when the total working population should take part in the direct production process of goods and services, with the highest attainable level of automation and the highest possible quality and durability. This maximum is obviously never reached, and the welfare efficiency is always below 100%. The higher the figure, the larger the availability of goods and services, and the greater the prosperity. The three determining factors are: 1. The occupation factor shows the percentage of the working population that takes part in the direct production process of goods and services in the public sector. Here it may be useful to list the professions that do not exist on the Iago or that fall outside the direct production process: banks, insurance companies, stock exchange, lawyers, sales organizations, public relations. Under text for picture of housing complexes. The ring-shaped housing complexes, looking much like huge glass silos, are about 900 feet in diameter by 300 feet high, and they accommodate about 10,000 Iagans each. The central core structure is built up complete as a single unit and the apartments are installed on the outside, which results in the glass-like finish. These circular housing units are arranged in rectangular cities about 10 kilometers by 6 kilometers wide, encompassing up to 36 such units. The resulting population density is as high as 6,000 persons per square kilometer. View of an automatic farming machine which is controlled from a central post. The unit works a piece of land 250 wide and 10 km long. Fertilizers and sprays are introduced via the central rail and administered by means of a rolling tank. At the end of the rails, The whole unit turns 380 degrees and returns over the parallel strip of ground.